Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Ryan Lehrer on WNYC, and Donald Trump's speech to the UN is getting mixed reviews. That's probably because it was a mixed-up speech, self-contradictory in so many ways, it may not have said anything. On the one hand, this.
In America, we do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example for everyone to watch.
And on the other hand, this.
Major portions of the world are in conflict, and some, in fact, are going to hell. But the powerful people in this room, under the guidance and auspices of the United Nations, can solve many of these vicious and complex problems.
I'm confused already. UN hands on or UN hands off? Well, later in the day, a toast to the United Nations.
And let's give this as a toast to the potential, the great, great potential of the United Nations. Thank you all for being here. Thank you very much.
So which is it? Stand by as a shining example or get in there and solve many of these vicious and complex problems? Joining me now to discuss Trump's first meeting at the UN General Assembly and how it may impact negotiations with countries like Iran and North Korea is Robin Wright, foreign affairs analyst and writer for The New Yorker. Hi, Robin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great always to be with you, Brian.
So you wrote for The New Yorker yesterday that the UN speech was President Trump's war doctrine debut. That would mean you think it was about something rather than about nothing.
I think that he was outlining not only the Trump doctrine in foreign policy, but the war doctrine, because when you look at the themes, it was confrontation, whether it was challenging the Rocket Man and claiming that the North Koreans were on a suicide mission, whether it was confronting Iran on the nuclear deal and suggesting that the United States was willing to either break from the agreement, an historic agreement, or actually support kind of a form of regime change. He was confrontational with China, Russia. He talked of implied military mission or military action to help the people of Venezuela restore their democracy. It's critical of Cuba. That the undercurrent throughout was not the kind of nuanced diplomatic speak that the United Nations is used to. It was really charging what the United States was willing to do militarily. And rather than being a collaborative effort, this was a kind of go it alone. We're going to do this and, you know, come along with us if you want.
So can you say in plain English when Donald Trump established that the U.S. would go to war and when it wouldn't and how that's any different from under Obama or George W. Bush?
Well, that's an interesting question because I think one of the flaws in his speech was the fact that he outlined the places that he feels are threatening, but he doesn't give any specifics of either what the United States will do or what the world should do. He kind of deferred in some ways to the Chinese on North Korea, the international community acting together to do something, but he didn't say exactly what. And I think that was the hole in his speech. There was a lot of rousing rhetoric, but not many specifics. And I think that's what people at this juncture of his administration are looking for. A lot of the policy review on foreign policy are not yet in. Remember the 90-day review on ISIS? Well, ISIS is being defeated in Iraq decisively and looks like it may soon be on the run even in Raqqa, its capital. And yet we don't know exactly what comes next. What is the strategy to deal with this most volatile region of the world?
Robin Wright from The New Yorker, my guest on WNYC. And listeners, if you have any comments or questions about Donald Trump's first address to a UN General Assembly or the issues that were raised by that speech, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Back to this idea of it being two competing speeches in one. Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, said the speech was really two speeches. Here's a little of what she said on MSNBC this morning.
I think it was actually two speeches. One in which somebody had written about the history of the UN and the importance of it, and the other written in a way to be much more nationalistic, I think kind of going up and talking about America first in that location. And then having listened to many speeches there, the tone of it was really bad, I think. And in so many ways, I think we all want to make sure that America's strong, but I think his speech weakened America, and I think was something that is going to make it very hard for us to carry on a lot of diplomatic work that we have to.
What do you think about Madeleine Albright's critique and the distinction she was making there between two strands of that speech?
The speech was clearly America first on steroids, and the thing that was so striking throughout was his constant reference to sovereignty, as if building walls not just on the Mexican-U.S. border, but building walls around borders all over the world was the solution to creating international security. And the irony is the United States is not exactly threatened when it comes to sovereignty. So it was the kind of nationalist agenda that played to his populist base. The question is, was it so confrontational? Was it so America first that it scared away both allies and rivals in terms of cooperating or finding solutions? And I'll tell you what was most striking was the contrast with the very first speech given by a U.S. president at the founding of the United Nations. Harry Truman in 1945 gave a speech in San Francisco, and he said the following: "We have to recognize, no matter how great our strength, that we must deny ourselves the license to do always as we please." He said, "The price of peace is that all nations must cooperate to avoid war and to learn the lessons of the Second World War." And so when you look at the kind of speeches that leaders have given in the past, this was in many ways quite strikingly different in the tenor, in the substance, and in the call to action.
Lisa in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I'm going to hearken right back to what was just said about Truman's comment, because that was my feeling when you mentioned, you know, Trump said, we're not getting involved, the United States doesn't get involved, but it is the job of the United Nations and all these great countries that are part of it to fix this hell in a handbasket. So I felt that he was saying, look, we're not doing this. As Truman said, you know, it is not our job to fix everything, and sometimes the price of peace is not getting involved. So that's what I feel he was saying, and I just wanted to kind of sort of talk about that a little and clarify that.
There was that line, Robin, and that's part of the self-contradictory nature of the speech to my ear, is he's talking about how it's not the U.S.'s job, it's the U.N.'s job to deal with these international conflicts, but by the same token, he's standing on national sovereignty 1,000 times, as you said, and saying we're not going to be tied down by the United States, by the United Nations. We're going to take action when we deem it in our interest.
Yes, and it was in contradiction in many ways to the themes of the 21st century, the period of interconnectedness, of globalization. It was very much kind of trying to unwind or unravel the process that's underway. It feeds to the kind of identity conflict or identity issues that have fueled so many of our conflicts. And one of the other contradictions I thought was most striking was the language he uses about calling the UN to act, and then he turns around and repeatedly has insulted the United Nations, talking about, well, it has potential. I pulled out one of the tweets from 2012 when he was a New York real estate magnate about the United Nations, and he groused that the 12-inch marble tiles behind the dais where the leaders speak, he said, were kind of cheap, and he offered to replace them. I mean, you know, it's just stunning what's happened in 5 years. Mm. And he was, in many ways, as insulting and as he was back in 2012 in his first appearance on the world stage.
My guest is Robin Wright, longtime foreign affairs correspondent, author of books about Iran and elsewhere in the world, now with The New Yorker, as we talk about the implications of Trump's speech at the UN yesterday. I want to ask, how different was this from a George W. Bush UN speech? And I wonder, maybe we forget too quickly that Bush's reputation around the world was that of a cowboy. That exact word was used so many times. And that he had disdain for the United Nations, ignored the world's rejection of our unilateral invasion of Iraq, as expressed at the UN in a vote, by just going ahead with it anyway. And then he appointed John Bolton, a genuine Trumpian nationalist, I think it's fair to say, as UN ambassador, mostly to give a big middle finger of contempt to the UN and any constraints on U.S. power that the collective action there might suggest. And I could talk about Ronald Reagan, too. So Trump may be more unleashed in his language, but maybe this is just the usual Republican relationship with the rest of the world. Check my memory if I'm wrong.
I think you're absolutely right on all of those points. But it is also true that George Bush promoted democracy around the world, and he was into nation building. And so, and you look at what happened in the aftermath of 9/11, and within a week, he visited the Islamic Center in Washington, D.C. And the language out of the Trump administration challenges that. The president said, we're not into nation building. We're not into supporting human rights. We're not into promoting democracy around the world in his UN speech. The language he's used about radical Islamic terrorists, as if every Muslim is a terrorist, or impugning a religion, has certainly not fostered the kind of tenor of the Bush administration. So I think there are stark differences, but you're right that George W. Bush people were afraid of. I think the fear today, and that rippled in the reaction across the General Assembly yesterday, the murmurs, the kind of gasps at some of the language, I think there is far greater fear or concern about President Bush than there was about President Trump than there was about President Bush.
Joe in New Hope, Pennsylvania, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm just going to say this very simply. There is nothing wrong with presenting a position that says this is a line to be crossed. Let's face it. Obama said in other places, here's a red line you can't cross, and Assad crossed it. We gave up. I don't like Bush. No, I have stronger words than that. But he needs
Trump.
To wake up
Trump,
this assembly.
Right?
He needs to, Trump, yes. He needs to wake up the assembly to these are real threats. And we seriously need to be ready to remove them. Otherwise, we just let it proliferate until, you know, every little country like anybody has nuclear weapons, which is disastrous. Somebody has to lay a line and say, stop it now. And while I don't like him, I like that he set a bar for what he did. Unconventional, yes. No question about it. That's what we've got to deal with. But there are on occasion times whenever someone like this, who seems revolutionary, has a right idea.
Joe,
you tell me I'm wrong. Go with it. Thank you.
Thank you,
Brian,
very much.
And Robin,
please call again. Robin.
Thank you, Joe, for your comments. I have to say that Trump, in outlining what is unacceptable, didn't actually draw red lines. He drew them kind of philosophically, but we don't know exactly. With the chemical weapons in Syria, there was a precise red line if he uses them again. On North Korea, there isn't that red line. On Iran, we're not sure whether the president's going to walk away from the deal or just try to supplement pressure on Iran with a new set of sanctions on other issues not related to the nuclear deal. I have to say that I did a piece about 2 weeks ago on what war with North Korea would look like. And in talking to military experts, it was one of the most chilling evaluations I've ever heard. And I've spent almost 50 years now covering wars around the world. And the idea that there would be tens of thousands of dead just in Seoul, there'd be a million casualties in South Korea, that it's the kind of thing that we would, as outlined, be destroying the regime and then being responsible for creating an alternative, whether it is reconstruction in North Korea, helping create a different kind of government, We learned in Iraq just how hard that is. We're learning still in Afghanistan just how hard that is. The idea of taking on a third open-ended long-term commitment that would see the deaths of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people would dwarf what our last conflict was. And there have to be other ways. I mean, I think the tough reality is it's going to be very hard to get North Korea to ever denuclearize. And I think the tenor of Trump's speech yesterday is actually going to confirm to the North Koreans that they want and need a nuclear weapon to defend against what they see as an intent to change the regime.
And when you talk about the horrors of a potential scenario of actual war with North Korea, this goes to the one line in the speech that I was personally the most horrified by. And I think Dave in Westchester was too, so I'm going to let Dave say it. Dave, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah, I want us to all just soberly look at the fact that the President of the United States threatened the largest act of potential mass genocide in human history in front of the world. Like, let that sink in. And, you know, I don't know what else to say.
Dave, I'm going to play. Thank you for that. And I'm going to play the clip. And folks, this is the clip you've heard a million times since the speech yesterday, but I think the media has been focusing on the wrong half of it. This is when Trump called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, which a lot of people thought was undignified at the UN General Assembly. Okay, maybe it was. Maybe it was a breath of fresh air. Ha ha ha, it was Rocket Man, it was a joke. Blah, blah, blah. Listen to the other part of this clip.
The United States has great strength and patience. But if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
We will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. He didn't say remove the dictator. South Korea has a policy of what they call decapitation, which is under extreme circumstances. They might actually go in and try to get Kim Jong-un. He said, totally destroy North Korea, which if you take it literally, and I know people always say take Trump seriously, but not literally, but these were his words, his actual words from the President of the United States before the world leaders of the entire world. He threatened what our caller just called the largest act of mass genocide in human history.
Well, I share your concern. And one thing that concerns me a great deal is whether the president himself understands the scope of what he's talking about. I think the generals around him do, his chief of staff, John Kelly, Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. And I think there is concern about what's next and how do you act? As Joe pointed out earlier, everyone in the world is concerned about Kim Jong-un's nuclear program. The problem is, how do you find a way out of this? And in some ways, the Iran nuclear deal, dealing with a diplomatic, getting a freeze, may be the only way to avoid a war. And the administration signaled that it doesn't think the Iran nuclear deal was a good deal, that it's an embarrassment, as Trump said, to the United States. And so what concerns me is that the vehicle, the way out of a war, kind of diplomacy, to get North Korea to stop advancing its missile and nuclear programs, is not on the table. I went to North Korea on the only diplomatic mission ever conducted by a senior U.S. official when Madeleine Albright went at the end of the Clinton administration in 2000. And, you know, the North Koreans feel paranoid about the West, about the United States particularly. There's no way Kim Jong-un is going to give up his nuclear weapons. Would he freeze them? Would he not use them? Would he pledge in exchange for whether it's humanitarian relief, not to advance the program any further? Perhaps. But there are pretty stark alternatives that are on the table, and I don't think there's anything in between.
On the word sovereignty, which you noted, Trump said over and over again, the LA Times counted 21 times in the 42-minute speech. So that's every 2 minutes for 42 minutes. He said sovereignty. What does it signal? It seems to me that it's used today by little countries and by our enemies to resist American internationalism, and by the U.S. to defend against internationalism by anyone else.
Yes. One of the interesting things is an analyst said to me last night, this is the kind of speech on the issue of sovereignty that the president of China might have given, saying that we want to cooperate with the international community on threats, but we are going our own way, and we're not going to accept democracy or, you know, foreign political ideas.
This is what Russia and China always say when the U.S. tries to influence human rights around the world, the idea of international standards on human rights. Russia and China say, wait, what about our sovereignty?
Well, even Britain is doing this now with Brexit, leaving the European community because it wants to, as it sees, protect its sovereignty. Well, it reflects in some ways also the bigger questions that we all face in the early part of the 21st century, and that is, who are we? And what are we willing to give up in order to be part of something bigger that may be better for whether it's peace or trade or in the environment? Those kind of broader regional blocks or the globalization process, the international treaties that ensure that we collaborate on the existential crises. And
so one of the problems is when internationalism is done badly, like these trade agreements that do really come home to haunt a lot of working class communities, at least in this country and arguably in some other countries as well, then that idea of making some trade-offs for a greater good gets discredited.
Totally. And in many ways, the tenor of Trump's speech yesterday really unwound the process that we're in. And as another analyst described it, it's a geostrategic recession that takes us in back from, pulls us back from the forces of the 21st century. And it's a real setback.
I like that phrase, geostrategic recession. I hadn't heard that before. And here's 17 seconds of how Trump put it when talking about sovereignty and America First and nationalism generally.
As president of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
Chilling to so many people when delivered at the United Nations, where it's supposed to be about, yes, putting the interest of your countries first, but not putting the interest of your countries only, and bringing those areas of common ground, bringing those areas of compromise, bringing the spirit that could allow for that, for the common good to flourish. And he was drawing the line differently. But at the end of the day, Robin, and we're just about out of time, does any of this matter? These were words on a teleprompter that he read, and maybe they were written largely by nationalist Stephen Miller or whoever, but they were just words on a teleprompter. Does this speech matter when we know Donald Trump says so many different things to so many different people?
I think it does matter enormously, and I think that this was his debut in the world. People were listening very closely, and the fact is that so much of the speech was about kind of aggression or confrontation, and that it didn't have the other half of the speech, which would have talked about the common good and what the international community could do on some of these broader questions. And so I think there's a void. I think because of the reaction in the room, that there was a sense that the United States is not providing the answers, the leadership, the role it used to. And so I think that you're looking increasingly at other corners, whether it's Angela Merkel in Germany, now the champion of the West, that there is a greater fear of the United States than there is that kind of admiration of leadership.
And just to extend for one more thought, that's, to me, always been the basic contradiction in Trump's approach to foreign policy. Trump, with this, as with so much, doesn't want anybody to be bigger and more powerful than him or than us. The United States has to be the big kahuna around the world. But he doesn't want the U.S. to take on the mantle of responsibility for a lot of things or to set values. And so that's so self-contradictory. Do you want us to be the big shot and not want us to be the ones who set international standards and try to enforce them? You can't have it both ways.
Exactly.
Robin Wright, you can read her take on Trump's UN speech and so much more on international affairs in The New Yorker. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.